Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, hello, hello. For the last time this series, with a guest at least, and welcome to the Starting Line podcast with me, Rich Lee. It's an interview podcast. We talk to entertainers, athletes, entrepreneurs, philanthropists, incredible people, successful people with great stories to tell. And we talk about their starting lines. Where did they start from? We all start from somewhere. And what did they do with that start? Just 12 weeks ago, I released the first episode of the Starting Line podcast back in August, and that was with Levi Roots. And as we approach the end of the first series, we're going to have another couple of episodes just behind the scenes, answering questions as well. So if you've got any questions, hello@startinglinepod.com or get in touch across our social channels at Starting Line Show, across most of them, or search for the Starting Line podcast on Facebook and LinkedIn, you'll find it there too. Comment on a post, DM, email, whatever you want to do. Get a question to me about the guests, about me, about the podcast, about anything you want, and we will answer them. But this has gone from an idea that I just couldn't get out of my head to a show that's consistently been in the top 1% of all podcasts, and it's charted pretty much every episode. We've had 3 OBEs, we've had 1 MBE, we've had world champions, world record holders, Olympic medal winners, multi-millionaires, and people giving back and supporting their communities in unique and incredible ways. As best as I can summarize, I think each guest is united by curiosity, resilience, and obsession, the pursuit of making theirs and other people's lives better. Today's guest is such a lovely person to end the first series on. Her name is Susie Chan, and Susie is an endurance runner, but she's unlike most you might know. Sure, she's ran the Marathon des Sables more times than any other UK female. She's broken the 12-hour treadmill world record in 2016. She's a distance runner that was named the number one runner to follow on Instagram by Runner's World and the Evening Standard. She's been on the cover of Runner's World, Women's Running, featured in plenty of other publications. She's commentated on tons of big events, and she is a Peloton instructor. But her route into running was not typical. Susie got into running when she was 35, 36. She, by her own admission, was a bit lost, smoking, drinking, a single mum, and without direction. She found running. Her brother, we'll obviously get into this in the episode, but her brother convinced her to do a half marathon. From there, it was a marathon. From there, it was a Marathon des Sables, again, a 6-day endurance race in the searing heat of the Sahara Desert, over 250 kilometers. She's an incredible person in that I think everybody I've spoken to about this episode has said, oh, wow, there's hope for me then. Because she is not somebody that's been doing this from birth. She was not a runner by nature. She said that her first half marathon, she wore an underwire bra, completely the wrong trainers, and she then just fell in love with it. And I think the beautiful thing is, this isn't me saying, everybody that listens to this, get out there, get running, that's what you should be doing. It's that acknowledgement that maybe we don't know what we're doing from the off. Maybe it's okay not to know what you're doing. And coming into something that tiny bit later, in mid-30s isn't old. I say that having just turned 36, so be kind. But she is an example to everybody that, yes, of course you can do it, should you want to do it. She is a wonderful, joyful, exuberant, bubbly personality to finish the series on. And I think exactly what I was trying to do, which is to show that no matter what your starting line was, you can absolutely take control and change the direction of your life. I'm incredibly appreciative of Susie's message. In fact, an hour before I sat down to record this intro and outro, she said it was an interview unlike any other she'd had, in which we spoke about so much more than just the running. It's just amazing to hear that the likes of Mike McCarthy, who was a journalist for 30 years, said it was the best interview he's done. And bear in mind, he's been interviewed by the media left and right because of the stuff he did with the Baton of Hope. Thank you very much, as ever. All that remains to be said is, without further ado, I bring to you my conversation with Susie Chan. Before this, I worked, I've been doing PR for 15 years now, but before that I was a personal trainer.
Oh, were you?
And I was a class instructor. No. Susie, look at me.
No.
I do like 10 metre bursts on a rugby pitch if and when.
Okay.
Not less and
you
less
just
now.
Just need to come to a class anyway.
I should.
We do walking classes, walk rounds and runs.
Yeah. I loved, well, I mean, loved and loved spin. I used to teach a lot.
Oh, you should definitely spin. I don't teach spin, but yeah, I don't do the bike, I just do the running. But it's definitely an experience. It's and I'd say every single class there's people fly over from America.
Really?
Yeah, there's people come. It is. We're very fortunate.
I can't do what you do. I can't switch off, and I hate my own head.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So do I. Oh yeah.
Really?
After I'm the master of distractions. Anything but the fact I'm running when I'm running.
That's the thing. I listen to you speaking to somebody about, counting lampposts and things like that.
Oh yeah.
And honestly, just anything, just to
anything but running.
Give you
the fact that I'm running.
Yeah. But yet you do it, and you do the distances you do.
Yeah, there was one race where it was absolutely, and it was deliberately mind-numbing. It's deliberately, so there's nothing to think about.
Where's that?
It's in a 400-metre track, and you just run around it for a day, 24 hours.
Where?
That was in Tooting, but they've moved it to Battersea.
That sounds...
It's sort of called self-transcendence.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently you're supposed to self-transcend.
So everybody's there, like, all zen, and you're like, oh, I hate this.
Oh, it was a mess. I was an absolute mess. But then afterwards, I can't remember. I cannot remember hours of it.
Really? How long was it?
24 hours. You're just there.
Like, 24-hour run, just...
Going nowhere, seeing nothing. It's just you and your own head.
How many things did you do?
Did about 106 miles.
It's funny because when you start talking distances like that, and again, I'm saying that, I'll go for a run for a mile. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
It's horses for courses, though, because I can't do 6 press-ups, so, you know.
I love your story. I love the way that you came into running. I love the way that you came into Peloton then. One thing I've not really heard much about is... you much younger. I've heard the 35-year-old Susie whose brother forced her into a half marathon, who found something. But I don't know anything about you before that. Tell me.
So I grew up, this is actually quite, now this sounds quite unusual and it's quite hard to explain, but I grew up in the grounds of a mental hospital.
I haven't heard this.
Because I can't just leave it at that. It's quite a long, I have to explain it. And so normally when I get interviewed, I just don't have the time. So my father is Hong Kong Chinese, my mother's English.
Right.
And they met when they were very young as student nurses. And when I was born, they were both nurses in a hospital called Brookwood Hospital in Surrey. And Brookwood Hospital, it was sort of, I think even then, I was born in 1975, even then it was a bit of a relic in that it was a live-in hospital for elderly people and mentally ill people, and it was a huge community. So
how big are we talking?
The grounds were huge. I don't know in numbers actually, because I was like
hundreds of people.
Hundreds. Hundreds, yeah, it was huge. It was like, it was a little village. It had its own shop, it had its own church, it had its own little museum in it. It was its own community.
Does it still exist?
It doesn't, no. Right. But it has been rebuilt into new build houses. Of course, they've kept the. Of course it has. But they've kept some of the really old original buildings. So in what was essentially a very white county of Surrey, yeah, there were a lot of, where I lived in Knaphill and Brookwood, I lived in a road and there was only one white family. We were just all children
because
of immigrants.
It was all student nurses.
We were all student nurses. So there were Filipinos, yeah, a lot of Filipinos, Hong Kong Chinese, just a real Indian, a real mix. And I grew up, and it was on the periphery of this hospital, and I just grew up in this world thinking that was...
Well, where was school?
School was in Knaphill, Knaphill First School.
Right, okay, so how far was that from where you lived?
Oh, it was, I just walked to school, right. I don't know. I mean, it seemed like a very long way, but actually now, as a grown adult, it's about half a mile. You know, I've got to walk to school in the rain. Most people in the school had parents that worked in this hospital. It's a very small little village.
Really on the self-contained.
Yeah, and it's next to a place called Brookwood Cemetery, which was right, one of the hugest cemeteries in the country.
Because you've got this mental hospital.
Mental hospital next to the cemetery, and then we're...
This sounds like a show. This sounds like a TV show. Like
and Brookwood Cemetery was, I think it was built, I think when the plague happened, and it was just a place for London to bury everybody. So it was all very Victorian buildings and nursing accommodation. And I lived in a house which was built back to front.
Again, please explain.
And this does still exist. There's a road. It's called Oak Tree Road. And they started building the road. And the houses were facing one way, and they realised that they were facing the wrong way to the road. So they switched them round. So half the houses had the front door, basically, with this lovely wooden front door opened into the back garden.
Right.
And the back door opened into the road. So that's where I grew up.
Right. Okay. So that's a wonderful start. How did your parents meet?
I don't know. I think they must have met as student nurses.
They met as student nurses.
It was the 70s. You know, I had an older brother and then I have a younger brother and sister who are twins.
Right.
And so you'd sort of, I would spend my, I don't know, Sundays, my dad would be working on a ward and I'd be the one sort of handing around the chocolates to the to like the geriatrics or whatever, or that sort of thing. I remember we were driving the car once through the hospital and he stopped and the person had crossed the road and then he waited. And I said, what are you waiting for? He said, oh, he has to cross the road three times. He can't just cross it. So it was that sort of...
What a wonderfully weird but
it was,
kind
it
of
was,
beautiful place
it,
to
it
grow
was,
up.
And then as the hospital got disbanded, as it would have done, because it was quite...
Do you know when that was?
Thatcher, 80s, I think, and during right, the 80s, and then became care in the community. And then my father worked with mentally ill people in the community. So I met a lot of mentally ill people as his patients, and there was a lot of them out there. So I was just... It was just very normal, like it is when you're a child.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, both your parents were nurses?
Nurses. My father has since become a doctor, and then my mother went to work at a university teaching student nurses. They split up when we were young.
How young's young for you?
10, and it was very acrimonious. Really? Very acrimonious, very rough.
Did that mean then split between two households?
Sort of, yeah. It was very, very, yeah, it was quite rough emotionally, I'd say, as kids. Nice. But we just, you know when you're just a child and you just crack on, don't you? You just crack on, don't you? You just don't really know. You just think, oh, okay.
I've divorced. I've got three children, so I've sadly had to take them through that too. And,
yeah, but you just,
you know, you do the best you can for them, but again, you just
you just go on with it.
Mm. Kids bounce.
I think, yeah, absolutely. You just adapt. So it just was what it was, and there was just the four of us. And strangely, my family, it was very acrimonious, and then that time passed, and we just sit down as a family, both parents together, have dinner together, at least once a month.
I mean, you can see though what they're trying to do. They're trying to make sure there's some degree of normality for you, right?
No, I think it's all very dysfunctional, but you know, in that family way. I think, and you know, so there's sort of those dynamics which only your siblings will understand.
Yes.
The nuances are going on those conversations, and you're like, oh, for God's sake. And it's like, and to an outside person, it would be like the most normal conversation ever.
Yeah.
And you're just getting wound up because it's like your mum. Do you know what I mean?
So, was there money? Were you like, you know,
we were absolutely skint.
Yeah.
We had no money. My mum was really poor. Like, we used to have a neighbour up the road. She used to work in the school, and she used to bring us the school dinners, leftovers to eat. Because she was just always, my mum has been, bless her, terrible with money. And so we were always just running around in the wrong shoes, you know, and like not the right clothes or whatever. Like I say, as kids, you just sort of crack on. But when I got to, I left as early as I could.
How old is that?
17.
Right.
I just went.
You just,
see you later.
Did you know that you always wanted to go as soon as you could?
No, yes, I think so, actually. Yeah. On reflection, I don't know. Like I say, you're just sort of doing your thing, aren't you?
Yeah.
And I was hanging around with, like, people, my peers. I went to work at the age of, I think I was, like, 13 when I got my first job.
And, what were you doing?
I worked in a bakery.
Nice.
Which was handy because I could bring the bread home when... So there's a lot of cakes and a lot of breads were consumed. And I think I did a paper round when I was younger. Then I worked at a bakery. Then I worked in a sports shop for Mike Ashley.
When, okay.
Back in the day, before he was Mike Ashley.
Oh, hang on. So for Mike Ashley?
For Mike Ashley, it was it was called Sport and Ski back then.
Right.
Back in the early 90s.
Wait, that's probably a better name than...
Yeah, then it changed to sports and soccer, and then it changed to Sports Direct.
Sports, do you know, I didn't know that sports soccer was the same one. Do you remember Donny? Do you remember Donny?
That's the one. That's exactly it. Yeah. I worked there, and it was, he used to be in Intersport. That's where he started, right. And then he just worked his way up.
So did you work with him, as in like...
He came in, yeah, this is years ago, in the early 90s. Yeah, he used to come in and check out the store. He only had a few stores then, and then it just, before our very eyes, just went...
How was that?
I loved it because I was very young. I'd found this sort of group of people who I used to go to the pub with. They just became my friends. I used to hang around with them. And we used to watch Formula One together. It was a very, from Woking, very Formula One sort of town. Just go to the pub together. And I just suddenly had this circle of people around me. Mm. And I was just very happy within it. And so I absolutely loved it.
You said you left home at 17. Were you close still to your family? Or?
Yeah, but I wasn't that far away. I lived in a little bedsit above a sofa shop opposite Woking Station.
Right, okay. So it really was just a game.
About the size of this room, yeah. It was at the fourth floor as well. Right. So,
all that way up. That's where your fitness comes from.
It
you know,
is.
You didn't realise.
Right back then, I was doing the fitness. So I was very unfit then. I just was out part. You know, it was just like the 90s.
How old are you?
17, 18, 19, and I was just studying. I was going to university. I did my degree in art history.
Were you good at school?
Do you know what? I was to a point. GCSEs I was. Worked very hard. I got something, I don't know, I got little awards for being, I was the right little spot. Yeah, I was. I was just to do my homework. I'd do it as soon as I got home to get it done, that sort of thing. And then I think it just went a bit AWOL. And
right.
At 17, 18, I just was like, just getting drunk a lot and just hang around with mates. It's what you do,
isn't it? Doesn't, yeah.
It is what you do. So the A-levels were trickier.
Yes, but you got through it?
Oh, yeah, I got through it and then got to university. And I had this ambition from the age of about 8 years old. I loved history. Again, bit of a spod. Loved history. And I wanted to work in a museum, or not any museum. I wanted to work in the British Museum, which was, as far as I could see, the pinnacle of all museums in the United Kingdom. An academic powerhouse, and it's as far as I was concerned, the top of the tree, and that's what I wanted to do.
What drew you to history?
I don't know, actually.
Was it a teacher? Was there one person? Was there somebody at school that you thought, do you know what, they've said that I've got
a gift
for
this? Do you know what, actually, that is unusual you said that. You've pointed that out. The only, I can remember the name of my history teacher, Mrs. Blackwell, but I can't remember the name of any other teachers. So that's interesting. I don't know. Maybe she was nice to me or whatever. I don't know where it comes from. But yeah, I remember being in her class and then she became a form tutor. And I remember being quite happy about it. Yeah. I would say now that not a single one of my PE teachers would recollect me at all. No clue.
Do you think...
No clue.
I mean, I wonder if they've heard of you since. I wonder if in the last 10 years or so.
Oh, that would give me a deep joy to think so. Not that I was particularly bad at PE.
What we need to do is you need to give us... If you can... Like, let's really think. Let's try and get some names. Let's go on LinkedIn. Uh-huh. And let's...
Honestly, my memory is...
Or we'll look at your school and we'll see if they put it in their past employers.
I went to St. John the Baptist School and before that St. Dunstan's.
Okay, we're going to look.
A very good Catholic.
Okay, so you weren't sporty then?
I was bang average, really. And you know what? To a certain degree, and we'll come on to this, I still am. And I don't think I was particularly bad. I was, actually, that's a lie. I was particularly bad at anything which involved any sort of racket.
Right.
Or... stick. Right. So any of those things was a flat no from me.
Right. Like, so if hockey out.
Hockey, no. Hockey, absolutely no. I just, it'd go through.
Is that a hand-eye coordination thing?
Terrible.
Okay.
Still like that.
Play netball? I think I heard that you played netball.
I did play netball. So that was the only thing I was actually good at was netball. And that was centre. I worked my way up. I grafted. I was too short to be defence. Yeah. But they put me in defence. And then I worked my way up to attack. And then I went to centre. And I was the day I became centre of netball was, I thought, up until the age of 35, the pinnacle of my sporting achievements.
Well, we can wrap up there.
See you later. See you later. Yeah, thanks. That's it. Yes. Yeah, I don't think... And I was good. They put me in the 4x100s, that sort of thing, at the end. I do remember being able to run, but not... You know, I wasn't running outside. I didn't do anything sort of out of the school hours. My mum didn't really help.
But did you have hobbies outside of school?
No. No, we didn't have anything, no. Just used to, like, borrow each other's bike and just pedal around the woods and that sort of thing.
That's such a normal... No, that's so normal. But kids don't do that now, though.
No, they don't.
Not to be all, you know, in our day. Yeah. Or my day, but, you know...
Back in our day.
Yeah.
But when my parents were together and we were really, really small, my dad used to ring a large bell outside the house to bring us in for dinner.
I mean, it's efficient, all right? It's efficient if nothing
like
else.
Like, bell, you'd hang on for as long as possible.
So you went to uni, and where'd you go?
I went to... It was called the London Institute back then, but it's the London... It's University of the Arts now. They've changed.
So, and they did a history degree there.
So... Art history, which I think they took off the curriculum recently and then put back on again. So I don't know where we are with that, but it was deemed so utterly useless that they took it off.
Are you big into art history?
Yes.
Yeah?
I love art. So it was art history and conservation. It was a joint degree because I thought, because art history itself is just... I've got a degree in old paintings. And then I thought, I'll do the conservation bit because that could lead on to a job in a museum because it's a practical skill. And I can remember being week one into the conservation element and realising I'd made a very grave error because I'm not very good at science.
Oh,
and they were using words which
that?
I couldn't even spell. Yes,
it was
chemicals. And it was chemistry, which I was bad at.
What did you do at A-levels?
I did politics, English literature and language as one, art history and classics.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. So it was all pointing in one direction.
It was.
And that wasn't science.
It was not science. But I just managed to pass science. I think I got like C, C and a C for science. And so it was, yeah, the sciencey bit of my degree was a massive drag factor. And
Was it all 3-4 years? What was the...
3 years.
3 years.
3 years, yeah. I was rubbish at that bit. I was constantly looking over other people's shoulders for that one. Like, what is micro spectroscopy? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you still remember it. So, yeah. Who's your favourite old painter?
It's about asking your favourite band because it kind of depends on your mood. I'm much more modern. So I used to fly through the old stuff and they'd be like, what's this? I'd be like, that's the Annunciation. And they'd be like, how do you know? I'm like, because I'm a good Catholic.
Right.
So I knew all the biblical ones and people were like, how do you know?
So you grew up Catholic?
I was Catholic, yeah. And so those were fine. But for me, it's always from the Impressionism onwards, Expressionism. Right. And then particularly I did my sort of thesis in the 1960s and the sort of pop art era. So that's sort of like what would be the equivalent of fast fashion now, but in the art world. And I loved all that. And I loved the whole ethos of Andy Warhol.
I was just about to say, forgive my ignorance, but I only know Warhol.
Yeah, but that's fine. He was the pinnacle of it.
I have done some work with the National Gallery over the years, and like Caravaggio.
They had
a big Caravaggio exhibition. So we did a real life reimagining of a couple of his paintings.
Did you?
Yeah. We did it in Trafalgar Square. We got this troupe over from Italy. So they were on Italia's Got Talent. And it sounds ridiculous that you can unveil
a scene
and people are standing up clapping.
It's
beautiful thing I've ever seen with my own eyes.
To try and recreate a live Caravaggio is astonishing.
I'll show you. I'll have to show you some photos.
I need to see that.
But what it meant was this troupe that we brought over, so they're from this tiny little town, I wish I could remember the name, and they all brought their families. I think the whole village came. So yeah, we recreated it all in Trafalgar Square. A couple of thousand people came and watched it.
Wow, that's the sort of thing I'd love to go to.
That was when I first started my PR agency, you know, that was kind of one of our first clients, and I couldn't believe my luck.
What a fun job.
Susie, so with what you do,
yeah,
I've heard you speak about your job now, and you're like, I can't believe it.
No, I can't believe what I do.
And I'm the same sometimes with some of the stuff that we do. I'm like, I can't believe I get paid to come up with stupid stuff and reimagine it in the world.
That's incredible. What a thing to do. I'd love to have seen something like that.
Yeah, so my knowledge, I love art, but my knowledge of the old masters and all that is limited.
I'm not very good with that, no. I'm like, oh, Wainwright, and that's it.
Is that right?
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, there's literally, I can just do like, oh, that's a Turner. Okay. But then it's like, I'm quite good in quizzes in that situation.
Yeah.
Up to a point, the very, very basic.
So you'll be my phone a friend one day, if ever.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I have actually been a phone a friend.
Have you really?
Go on. it's really weird.
I bet it is. Tell me more.
It's very weird. So my friend Ewan Thomas is he's an Olympian, 400 meter. He was on Millionaire, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll be your friend. It was for art as well. He was like, for art and all that. Yeah, I was like, yeah, I can do art. It's fine. Art and museums. He said, art and old stuff. But what they have to do is somebody, you have a pocket of time with which they're recording, and a vigilator has to be with you the whole time.
Just in case
he calls.
Are you the only phone a friend? I've always wondered.
No, they have a few apparently,
which is ridiculous. So they've got like five people watching.
No, I think the maximum they can have, I don't know, but I can't remember. It was only a really small number. But then, so somebody turns up at your house, like, and they're like, "Hello, I'm the invigilator," and then you're just sort of like,
"You've got this stranger
like a
in
cup
your house,
of tea, you know, waiting for the guy. He never called.
Ah,
I know.
So nothing came.
But
up.
I'm sort of glad he didn't, because there's quite a lot.
That's a lot of pressure.
It's quite
there?
A lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then if you get it wrong,
yeah,
it's a bit. I don't mind getting it wrong for myself, but it's a little bit...
So...
I went to art college.
Art college, mm-hmm. you're thinking about the British...
British Museum. And then what happened, amazingly, again, just coming back to celebrating mediocrity, I was bang average in my class, like, because the science, I was very bad at the science, but I was okay at the art bit. Right. But then we also actually did some practical art, and I was always encouraged by art teachers. They said, you're good at art, you should do art. And I thought I was good at art... And then I went to art college and realised I was absolutely shite at art.
Because
everybody else was like, it really exceptionally good at art. So my art was kind of average. My science was poor, but I knew the pictures. And then by complete chance, and this is one of those moments, the university had set up voluntary places where people were just placed into summer for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it was literally names out of a hat. And they pulled out the British Museum, Susie Chan.
You are joking.
I'm not joking.
You got the sorting hat. You got the...
I don't know what... Yeah, I don't know what happened there. And everybody was like... Durr! And I was like, oh my goodness. So I got to volunteer at the British Museum.
You didn't fudge that in any way. You didn't make that happen.
Absolutely.
No,
no idea that was going to happen. It was a complete chance
That's
thing.
Wonderful.
And then I got to volunteer for 2 weeks. And the museum itself is... it's a very popular place. Lots of people want to work there. Mm. And it's actually really difficult to even become a volunteer. Like now, I don't know what the process is now, but this is back in the mid-90s. Mm. So it was probably less streamlined as it is now. But it was actually really difficult to get in to be a volunteer. So I got to volunteer for 2 weeks. I was just like a sponge soaking it all up. I worked in the medieval department in clocks and watches.
Wow. Did you learn a lot about clocks and watches quickly?
I did. I could take apart a small pocket watch and put it back together again. So I was sort of doing some conservation. It was very, very light touch stuff because I was only there for 2 weeks. But then... they said, do you want to stay on? And so I went back and worked a day a week or a day every 2 weeks for the rest of my degree. And
why do you think they asked you to stay on?
I don't know. It's free labour, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, I got on quite well with them. It was quite nice.
So it was free. You weren't being paid to do that?
Not at all, no. I mean, when I did get a job there, I was still barely paid to do it. So really? the wages were very, 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 very low in that
Do you
job.
Think that's because they know they can?
Yeah. So I... did the voluntary work, passed my degree, and then between the end of my degree and actually graduation, I'd managed to bag a job at the British Museum. And I think they had over 420 applicants. And the only way I'd got through was because I'd done that voluntary work and because those people in that department had written my sort of references.
There is that apprenticeship aspect of, you know, if you really want it, you've got to put yourself in a position where other people don't want to be.
I think that sector in particular, generally speaking... I would say the average sort of, I don't know, this is from my recollection from back in the days. People are they come from quite wealthy families.
That's exactly where I was going to get to.
Yeah,
Susie,
yeah.
How did you cope with that?
I was just skint all the time.
You just struggle your way through.
Yeah,
because
I had to get a job in a pub. So my first job, I got the job, it was a museum assistant, which was, and I cannot tell you how much I deeply loved that job. Like it was just it was like the fibre of my being. I loved being in that building. I was paid £10,100 a year.
Ooh, as much as that.
And I had to go and work in a pub in the evening 4 nights a week just to get by. It was it was really fun. It was a great place to be when you were young. I mean, I literally didn't have enough money to pay my gas bill. I was on my put into a meter and I would sit there in the dark sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't know. But however, the job would be like, oh, Susie, can you go to Japan next week? We've got to do this exhibition. And I'm like, yes. And so I was flying around
Genuinely flying around the world.
Yeah. Going to Japan. I mean, I went to all of the, I traveled a lot. The job had a lot of travel because we'd have to take museum objects from the British Museum and put them on exhibition in other museums around the world. And there was all these sort of exchange of objects around the world. And I did that. So I was sort of jetting off.
Yeah,
with like, you know, you're on emergency electric or something. Yeah, and I come home and sit in the dark and like have a pot noodle for dinner. It was really contrasting. It was really, really, I loved it though. I loved it. It was sort of.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Totally worth it.
So you just graduated?
Yeah, 22.
So you're 21, 22.
And
working at British Museum. You'd always
job
wanted
of my
that.
Life. Job I really wanted to do my whole life. Got there and I was flying around the world and I made all these. I know, it was just fabulous. No money, but I didn't care because I was sort of, I was happy and I went to the pub and I worked in this pub and I made friends working in the pub. Yeah, it was great. It was happy days.
And your folks still with us?
Yeah, both out. Yeah, both are. Yeah. Both retired.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Quite proud of you, I'd imagine.
No. It's not the Chinese way. Yeah. No, I wouldn't. Maybe they are. I don't know. They wouldn't say, I am proud of you, Susie. Well done. It's just like, oh, yeah, well done. But I think in particular, the running, they just simply don't understand, which I can respect that point of view. Because the first time I did a really big run, I was like, don't tell Dad. Because he will just see it as the most ridiculous waste of energy and time possible. To some degree, he's not wrong, is he? Well, no, you can. It's quite.
Does it drive you? Does it upset you?
I would say I'm sort of indifferent to that. I would say because it's not. It's just not his thing. It's just not his thing. So it doesn't bother me that he's sort of indifferent. He's neither here nor there about it. I think he's probably at the beginning. He was a bit against it. Cause it's like, why would you do that? Why didn't you just do something else with your energy? And now he's very, very used to it. And now the only time actually saying that when I think he was slightly proud of me was when he came to work at Peloton and he saw, because it's very hard to explain to those that aren't familiar with Peloton and how it works and how big it is and how the company operates. When he came to work and he saw, like, there's these huge pictures of, like, me and, like, all these people have come to run with me. And then there's, like, the photos. And it was a real moment. And he was like, oh, she's doing quite well.
That was quite special for you.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think that was probably the moment he realised that I probably wouldn't ask him to lend me another 100 quid.
So was he proud of you, do you think, when you were working at the museum? Because that's quite a story.
I think proud's a bit strong. It's just not a Chinese thing to be proud. It's always like, more money. Right, okay. I think it was a good job. It was a good job. It sounded good. And it was a steady job. You know, it was civil service.
Yeah.
So it sort of ticked all the boxes. But the pay was diabolical. So I think so, yeah. I think so. I think they probably both did. Yeah. They just maybe didn't say it.
No. Where's your mum from?
She is from the UK. So she is, I don't know where she's from, Dorset, I'm going to say.
Right, okay.
Originally, somewhere around there.
Lovely part of the world.
A lovely part of the world. Yeah. Not so interested, I would say, no.
No?
She liked the museum stuff. Can't really get her head around the fitness stuff. She'll phone me, she'll go, I've got a sore knee. And I'm like, I'm not a physio, mum. Like, but you run. Do you get sore knees? If I've got a sore knee, why's my knee sore? Yeah. Stop on it.
Cheers, man.
That's the level of expertise that she'll rely on me for.
How has it been mixed race child in the 70s?
See, this was something which I was not aware of because I was in this environment, really. But if you step outside of that environment, it was quite white, but there was a lot of Italians in my school. And then Woking itself has the oldest mosque in the country, so a lot of Muslims. It was actually very multicultural. It was like this little multicultural hub right in the middle of Surrey. So I was very... it genuinely didn't occur to me that people didn't use chopsticks or on the regs. I was that naive. I think naive's probably the word I'm looking for. And then when I got to secondary school, I can remember somebody saying to me... And she didn't mean it in any harm at all. They were talking about dinner and what you're going to have for dinner. And I can't remember what I said. I said, oh, I can't remember what was going to happen. It was invariably involved rice. And she went, oh, yeah, you're slightly different, aren't you? And I went, oh, what do you mean? She went, yeah, but you're like Chinese. And that was the first time. And I can remember having a real like, oh, people look at me differently. Yeah. I can remember having a really like, oh. And it wasn't, she didn't mean any harm. And I wasn't actually even offended. It was just like
a realisation.
I was like, oh.
I wonder how it was for your parents.
I don't know. I think where they ended up when they were together, it was quite a safe environment. There was always somebody having like a barbecue on a Sunday or there was always like the most incredible cakes and like the food was just... And I just thought everybody just had incredible stir fries and Filipino cakes. The only time I was hyper, where I've had full out and out racism was when I was about 22 and I went backpacking with my brother. And I was like, I'm going to find my roots. I'm going to go. He lived in Hong Kong at the time. So I went in Hong Kong. Hong Kong's absolutely fine because there's absolutely tons of mixed race people there because it's Hong Kong.
Yep.
And then we're like, let's go to China. Let's go to Beijing. And then we're like, let's go. And like, you know, I was learning Chinese. I was trying to get in touch with my roots a bit then. I was reading a lot about Chinese history. And I went to China and, unbelievable racism.
You're joking.
Oh, yeah, people would just come and spit you on the street. It was unbelievable. And they were sort of swearing at me. Like, and I had to decode what they were saying. And they're properly swearing. Yeah.
Why? Awful. It's because you're mixed.
Well, this was late 90s. So we're pre the Olympics.
Yeah,
so
it doesn't even sound that long ago, Susie.
I think in terms of Chinese, at the time in China, the... tourism really was only if you would go in on a cruise or quite a big organised tour. So backpacking wasn't really a thing for a start. And so I think that was quite unusual in itself. And then these two half Chinese people. And people, I had my hair pulled. I was hit with a stick by a policeman. It was unbelievable. And I can remember like thinking, huh, this isn't what I was expecting.
I'm never coming back here
again. I was so naive. And then we went to get a train ticket to try, because we were really travelling on no money, to go and see the terracotta soldiers. And there was a train station, and they had a foreigners-only window. And it was only open for like 2 hours a week. So we couldn't queue up and buy tickets. You had to wait until that day of the week to go and buy the ticket. And then when we went there on the allotted day of the week, there was just a sea of Chinese people ahead of us. They didn't queue. And so we were sort of trying to fight away before the ticket office closed. Unbelievable. I was like, I was going to go there for a month. Honestly, 2 weeks, I was on a plane to Bali. I was like, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to go to the beach. Yeah, it was very tough. And it was a tough country to try and navigate around as a backpacker. It just wasn't really a sort of backpacking place. And I have got a good story from my time in China. So we went to see the Great Wall of China.
Yeah.
And this is quite bad. And we're like, let's go to the Great Wall. And so there's a few points where you can go up on cable car because it's on the top of a mountain range. So travelled out on a bus, got off in the middle of nowhere, but there was this little cable car to go to the top of the Great Wall of China. After sort of gesticulating and me using my terrible Chinese, we got two tickets up to the top of the Great Wall of China. We're up there, me and my brother, and it was like, oh, my God, Great Wall of China. Take my photo. We're just walking up and down. It was just us two up there. And it was like, it's absolutely beautiful. And my brother's like... It's really quiet. Why is it so quiet? And then we looked and they'd switched off the cable car. And we were like, oh, okay. So we wandered back to the cable car and we were like, we've got return tickets. Sort of like, and he was like, no, it's off now. Sorry. sorry, no. We were like, but can we? We need to get off.
Yeah, we can't stay.
We need to get off this snowy mountain because it's like the sun's setting. And he was like, absolutely not. He refused to switch on the cable car, so we had to walk off this mountain. Hours. Well, this was the tipping point. This is where, like, I'm going to Bali. Right. We finally, like, I don't know how long we were walking down this mountain for, and then we were on this road in the middle of nowhere. There were no buses. There was nothing. And so I got all the money, all the yen I had in my pocket out, and I flagged down a car. And I waved the money in his face. I said, take me to McDonald's. Right? And I said that because if there's a McDonald's, it means there's a town. And yes. If there's a town, then there's like to be a hotel.
Right.
So I was like, take me to McDonald's.
That's a great travelling tip.
And it was about an hour and a half in this car. And he literally practically drove me through the front doors. And then I decided that I would go on holiday elsewhere.
Yeah. So not been back to China since?
No, and actually, I'd like to go because it has. Yeah. I'm almost certain it's changed. It's changed a lot. It's been, you know, there's a lot more cultural exchange, and the Olympics, I think, was a real moment for them.
How long were you at the British Museum?
I was 97. I was there for about 10 years. I'm going to say
right,
and then I moved from there, and it was an absolute wrench to move. But I moved from there to get out of London to take my daughter because
you had your daughter at 26, didn't you?
26, yes.
So you're only a few years into your career, really.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I felt like I'd been doing it a long time, I think, at that point, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because it was quite... I found it was very immersive. It would be... I would really genuinely look forward to going to work on Monday. Yeah. I'd be like, oh, yeah.
So how was that then when you had your little one?
Yeah.
Did you take her in? Like, you know, what was the situation? Like,
It was a bit hard, actually, because I did the maternity leave and I had to go back because I had to keep paying the bills. And then I just had to go back to work, which was a bit of a shame. But she just went to childcare and then to nursery
and
then
to school.
You just, I don't know how. I don't know how I managed to make it work. I just needed to move out of London for her just to be, just to have a little bit of, I just needed to refocus because I was a bit sort of, I felt like I needed to sort of just realign my life again a bit because I was just in this job, and I loved that job. I could tell you I loved that job, but I knew it was dead end.
Right.
There were people.
So there was no kind of, like, levels.
Very difficult. Very, very difficult. Yeah, there'd be like it was very, very difficult to progress. There are people that have been doing the job which I was doing for like 20 years.
Right.
And so I just thought, as much as I love it, and I could have stayed doing that job forever.
Yeah.
And some of my friends are still there doing that job. And I just thought, oh, I need to try and do a little bit better here.
Mm.
And so I resigned, which broke my heart. I split up with my daughter's dad all in the same week. I was like, right, okay.
Life change.
Here we go. Switch things up. And I moved to Farnham in Surrey, which was sort of near enough my mum and my dad, who live separately, but not so close, I could just turn up. So.
And
But near enough. So
near enough,
like,
that you can get the.
Yeah, you're not passing. Yeah.
I mean, was that then difficult in terms of? Again, it's a very personal question, but in terms of the breakup and then moving away from that, like, you know, was he part of your daughter's life?
He sort of was and wasn't. He's right. Great. He's a great guy. But I just sort of cracked on with it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you know something's for the best.
Yeah.
I was still, by this point, very poor, though. It's a theme. I had no money. And I couldn't quite afford to get back into the museum world. And I couldn't afford the commute, basically. Mm. So I just sort of took a local job just for a couple of years, just to sort of resettle.
What was that doing?
Oh, it was awful. Okay, I hope nobody at the council is. I worked for the local council for a little while.
They know it's awful.
It destroyed me from... It was. I genuinely, I couldn't watch The Office because I didn't find it funny.
Because it was live.
Because I was like, what is this? This is like a documentary of my life. I can't watch it. I just didn't really ever fit in.
Really?
I didn't really fit into that one.
Because
I was a bit sort of
extroverted and your
I wasn't then. I was actually quite shy, but I was just. It was just wasn't my vibe.
Right.
It was just all like, oh, hello, the land I have grown, and they're like too much. I'm like, oh, I don't care. Like, you know. So
you did that for a bit.
I did that for
what
a bit. I answered the phone for planning complaints.
Are you destroyed already? Yeah, I can't imagine. Like, nobody's calling you saying, hey, good morning.
Yeah, no, it was a lot. It was
right,
a lot. So I did that for a bit just to sort of pay the bills. And then I got back into museums and I worked at the South Bank Centre at the Hayward Gallery, which was contemporary art, which actually thrilled me because it's actually the same job, but it's just different things, different million pound things you're hanging on the wall or putting on a shelf or whatever.
Yeah.
And what was interesting for that is we were more often not working with artists who are still alive. So I met some fantastic artists. Anthony Gormley, mm-hmm. Grayson Perry, brilliant people, absolutely brilliant people. Bridget Riley, I met who's. I was like... So I used to bring my daughter. So when I worked at the Hayward, I used to bring my daughter when she was quite small and just ask her what she thought of the exhibitions. And it was so refreshing to have a five-year-old. And she'd be like, I really like that. And I'm like, why? Because just when I look at it, it makes me feel nice. And I'd be like, brilliant. Like,
It literally is that simple.
Yeah. It's that simple.
And it is finding kind of beauty in small things like that. So kids are wonderful at that.
Yeah, it was great. So I worked there for a while, actually really enjoyed it, but I did have a bit of a yearning for museums again, because it's the same job, slightly different vibe. There was parts where I'd be like, oh God, you know, what are you... Having long conversations with people and they're talking about moons, like literally 2 millimetres, and I've just spent like 2 hours putting it on the wall. And I'll be like, okay, no, it's fine, we can move it 2 millimetres, it's fine, let's move it. Let's just take it all down and move it 2 millimetres to the left.
Do you think they were just messing with you?
Is there art?
Is there art?
Is there art? No, I did enjoy it, but yeah, I wanted to go back to... There was something, so that I'd look at a piece of art, it'd be like, okay, this is incredible, this is worth, I don't know, £17 million or whatever it is, something like that. Oh, it would be absolutely incredible. And then people would have these very, very long conversations about it, and it'd be like, beautiful, beautiful. But I also yearned for the pot, which was just had been in somebody's house X thousands of years ago, and it was just a very humble pot, for example. And I'd be in the museum, and I'd be like, somebody's just used that like 2,000 years ago, that's and here I am right now looking after it. And that used to blow my mind in the museums. And so I sort of missed that. It's less sort of created, and not forced is probably the wrong word, but when you look at art, like somebody sat there and they planned it, they've done it, designed it, and they've executed it. And in a museum, you'll just have literally just, I don't know, like a shoe which somebody has worn in Egyptian times. You'd be like, look at that! Somebody wore that!
And that's what gets you.
That used to make me super excited. And so I went back to museums.
I wonder, does legacy matter to you and what you leave behind?
I don't know. Nobody's ever asked that question before. Maybe a little bit.
Just as you said that, then I was thinking, okay. So is that permanence of something? You know, like the world record and.
Well, yeah, but people say you die twice, don't they? When the day you die, and then the last time somebody says your name. Yeah. No, it's never. I don't. I'm not doing the things I'm doing. So I'd be like, I want people to talk about me for years after I'm dead. Not at all. No. I haven't really thought about it like that. I'm not a very deep thinker, I'm afraid, Rich.
You've spoken much more deeply than you've possibly given yourself credit for. It's, you know, to say that you can look at a pot that's thousands of years old, and you're looking at that for reasons of its permanence and almost not because somebody created it to be looked at.
I think it was the history element that excited me, rather than the art. I love art, yeah. But there's an extra dimension when you add in history, isn't there?
Yeah, no, I think
there really is. I'm the sort of person that if I'm in London and there'll be like an old building like there is, and I'll look at a step and it's been worn down over time, and the building's like from the center, and I'll think, oh God, look at that step's been worn down.
And
all
then
those,
you're telling
all
me
those
you're...
people that have stepped on this step.
And that's deep thinking, Susie.
You're... Oh, okay, I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, so I think that in particular was what I missed. And also, yeah, it was just... The humble things, the sort of everyday things. And then occasionally I'd be in the job in the British Museum and something would... You had to treat everything the same, all objects are the same, value didn't matter, whatever. But now and again I would be stood there and I'd be looking at something I'm holding and I'd be like, oh my God. I remember once I saw Queen Victoria's Christmas cards from her kids to her. And I was like, holding them. And I was like, oh my good Lord. This is incredible. I'm stood here holding these things, yeah. And I did get it with art, but it was, I didn't find it, quite as satisfying for some reason.
What is your most favourite piece that you've ever
So
you've
I do with? Have a favourite object. I worked in the Department of Asia, and there's some incredible Japanese objects there. I've got real fondness for everything Japanese. However, this is a real level geek. So the thing, and the reason I'm going to pick these is because I had a little postcard of them, and I remember saving my money from the bakery to go to London to the British Museum to look at these objects. It was a Lewis chessman, and these were little chess pieces which were found on the Isle of Lewis. I can't remember the history about them. I'm sure somebody else will fill you in on that. and I just they were just beautiful and fascinating little ivory carved pieces.
So you ended up working with them, so something that you bought postcards
It took me years in the British Museum to get anywhere near them because I was in a different department, but I then... so they're just beautiful. I bought this postcard and I had the postcard at home. And then I was on, I went on loan to, it was called the Treasures of the British Museum, and it toured the world. It was a global tour. Like, it's like sort of rock tour, but with museum objects. The Lewis Chessmen were part of it. And I was just absolutely delighted to be able to finally pick them up. Not with my bare hands, I had gloves on, conservation. Yeah, yeah. But just to be like, and I remember thinking these were the things that I came to see.
The reason that interests me, and you're saying about nerding out, every single person is obsessive. All of these people are undoubtedly successful in their own right, are doing their own things, you know, have achieved, you know, fantastic things. But for most people, it's not the financial reward of the thing that they are obsessed with. If you spoke to David Attenborough, do you think he gives a shit about being famous?
British Museum, I had afternoon tea with David Attenborough because he was a trustee of the British Museum.
How was that?
Oh my gosh, honestly, I can't believe, like, this is before camera phones, you know what I mean? Yeah. He was just as affable and lovely as you would expect him to be.
I'm so glad to hear
and
it.
And it was in Coins and Medals where I worked in that department before I moved on to the Department of Asia. And he was a trustee and he came in and we had afternoon tea. It was all the trustees came in. And somebody brought some homemade scones in and they'd put the scones on the table and then they went off to get the little side plates and he didn't even wait. He'd straight in, jam and cream were down his tie and he was like, oh, ho, ho. And I was like, oh. David Attenborough.
You're everything I hoped you'd be.
Oh, this moment, I'm going to bottle it. Yeah.
All he cares about is being great at the thing that he cares about, right? And you know, and that's almost a wonderful thing. So what I hear when you talk about those things and the fact that you had that postcard on your wall, and it's a curiosity and then obsession. The fact that you can remember them, you know, and it just fascinates me. The fact that, you know, that undoubtedly translates into the running.
Well, nobody's ever put it together like that, but maybe you're right. Yes, I've never thought about it.
I've picked at these threads with everybody I've spoken to, and I don't think I'm imagining it. But everybody that I've spoken to is in some way, shape, or form that obsessive about the things. Yeah. You know, and for you, it was right. I want to work there.
Yeah,
I'm gonna work there.
Yeah, I've wanted to work
and
there.
And you did. You know, so. I'm just trying to pick up the thread of where we were. Where
so
we got to.
So I am now back in museums. I went to work at University College London. Somewhere between working at the Hayward Gallery, the Arts Council Collection, which is where I was sort of based in the Hayward Gallery, and University College London, I was single mumming it, just trying to juggle everything. And then that's when my brother asked me to run a half marathon.
No, it always, the two things, your brother asking you to run the marathon, we'll definitely get a half marathon, we'll definitely get onto, but at that point in time, what was your life like?
Pretty stagnant, I think, would be the word.
Yeah.
So I wasn't massively fired up about the job I had. Nothing could have compared to the British Museum because that was the problem I had. I can remember thinking it whilst I was doing it in the British Museum. Like, this is for me. This is the job I wanted. Mm. I'm doing it. And like, I'm 23 years old, now what? And so nothing could quite compare. And the slightly higher up I was working up, the more admin-y it got. And the more I was like, oh, I have to write something about strategic policy. And it was incredibly boring. Yeah. And I wasn't hanging a painting on the wall anymore. And so it was fine. It was actually fine. And University College London, where I was working at, they've got their own teaching collections. The people I met there, brilliant. And I have always enjoyed being one of the thickest people in the room. Like, there's always somebody like that, really intelligent people. And so this is my job. I'll just wander around.
But you're just learning, right?
Yeah, I was just constantly dropping information in. I can remember having a conversation with an astrophysicist and he was explaining a particular type of black hole to me. And I was like, can you explain it to me like I'm five? And he went, okay, this particular black hole bends space so much, if you stood in it, you'd be looking at your own arse. And I was like, that's the sort of level of science I can
get. Where's that
at
school? You then might have been okay when you came to the
I was constantly surrounded by these really bright, intelligent people. So it was great. But then I would come out of my job, I'd go home, and I'd be single mum, and it's really hard, without any money. And I'd just be sitting at home because I didn't have any money to do anything. And that'd be it. So I was sort of slightly stagnant. And I can remember it was like a real moment for me. Like, I can't remember how old I was. I was like 34 or something. And it was my 35th, and it was my birthday. And I woke up with knits because my daughter had given me knits.
Bloody school.
Bloody, honestly, there's a lot of knits going around in primary school. I don't know. They just disappears when they leave primary school.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there and I was like, this is a low. Like, this is, I've gotten it. This is my birthday. There's nobody to celebrate. I haven't got a present because my daughter's too young to buy me a present. And like, it's just like, right, I think I need something in my life. So I was just sort of, I felt like in my own personal life, I was just sort of existing really. And I'd moved to Farnham. And here we go back to that little story you said about being a bit of a fish out of water. So I was, it's a lovely town, Farnham. Quite right. I was never the mum at the school gates.
Right.
And I and to my poor daughter, I was continually making these really sort of small mistakes because I was sort of always rushing to get the train, trying to do my job and then get back for her. So like, I remember one, it was a summer term, and I sent her in to school with the wrong colour summer dress on because I didn't know what the colour. And I was just like, and I got a letter back and I was always like, and they used to always just like, can we have some money for the school trip? And I couldn't quite send them the school trips. And so I was a little bit... So I was always that sort of mum, and I couldn't bake a cake.
How did you feel when you were like?
Oh, point? It was very demoralising. Yeah. It was just.
I mean,
like,
it is,
oh,
isn't it?
God, I'm not one of those. I'm, you know, and people didn't know who I were. If I did turn up to pick my daughter up, like, I'm sorry, who are you here for? And I'm like, my daughter. Like, honestly, it's just it wasn't. So it was. I was quite. I always felt like I wasn't great at being a mum because I was trying to sort of just
balance everything,
pay the bills.
I mean,
yeah.
It's admirable. It really is. Since breaking up with my wife, that's 5 years ago almost. You know, I've had those moments as, you know, dad of three, where you're just there and you're like, I'm failing so badly.
Oh God, yeah, I'm failing so badly. Look at all the other parents.
I
had a crap car. I lived in an ex-council house, which fortunately I owned. And like, I just couldn't, I mean, literally couldn't afford, the carpets were literally threadbare. And I had to buy a cheap rug and put it on top. And so I was just sort of doing my best, but you're just like, you know, you think, oh God.
You're just existing, and then, you said it right.
Yeah, and I can remember baking, it was like cake sale. Like, okay, so let's bake a cake. Tried to bake a cake, didn't work. It kind of exploded out of the sort of holding. So I scraped it, put it in and iced it. And I just took to Lily, take it in. I said, buy it back. Make sure you buy it back. Of course she didn't. And now, so whoever's bought that cake home, the slice only just been a mess inside. I was like, oh God. Anyway, yeah. So I was that sort. I wasn't.
But you tried.
Well, yeah, I tried. I started to run, and I thought, oh, this is cheap. It's not cheap, is it really, because of trainers? But I thought, I can do this in my lunch hour.
Yeah.
And my brother, I think he saw a bit of it in me.
So it's your older brother?
So it's my younger brother.
Younger
brother, Alan. I think he sort of saw this in me, and he was like, okay, I'm running a marathon. And I was like, what? And he said, and I'm going to run this half marathon. It's really near you, so you're going to run it with me? And I was like... No. I didn't even know how long it was. I was like, it's a half marathon. I didn't even know how far it is. And then we signed up. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna start running. Mm-hmm. And I did a couple of things. I went to a little local boot camp, which I genuinely loved. And this is where I was sort of, I definitely did. I felt quite isolated in Farnham because I was just sort of just doing my thing and commuting back and forth to London and just spending the weekends by myself. And then I went to this little boot camp and I made some friends through fitness, and they were like, oh, come out, you know, why don't you come out on, you know, we're going to go out for a meal or whatever. And I found this little group of friends. So that was nice. And I started running, and I can remember trying to run and not being able to, really, just trying to run like around a football pitch and not being able to do it.
And you say not being able to do it, like
without stopping. Yeah. Right. I was like, oh God, a bit wheezy. Yeah, probably the tar in my lungs. I've had so too of it. But,
yeah. I guess that's the wonderful thing is, so you're 34, 35, training for a half marathon. You don't know how long that is.
So I was back then. I was still sort of. Was I? Yeah, I was. I was still working at Guildford Borough Council, so there's a bit of an overlap with the timelines here. Yeah, so that's when I sort of started running, and then did the half marathon, and then just I crossed that half marathon finish line. I was absolutely terrified at the start, like just terrified, like oh my goodness, I didn't know how far I'd run in training because I didn't have like watches and things now. I don't remember that, but did it, and I can remember when I crossed the finish line. Being absolutely elated, like proud, elated, just like I couldn't believe I'd done it. And it just, the afterglow was like powerful, like really, really powerful. So it was a real moment, and I was like, I couldn't walk, like I literally couldn't walk down the curb. But I was like, I'm gonna run, I'm gonna become a runner. And then I joined.
The funny thing was, you were already a runner at that point.
But you probably wouldn't have called yourself.
But do you know what? Actually, that's so true, because people say that to me and I find, and I'm like, stop it. When they say, oh, I'm not really a runner. I'm like, oh, I did this 10K. I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah. So actually, thanks for picking me up on that. That is absolutely true. And then I joined a local running club, which took a bit of courage to pluck up and do, because I thought I was going to be too slow or whatever. Not wearing the right trainers or whatever.
You did the half marathon in a underwired bra.
I did, yes.
That's not a good idea.
Well, no. On reflection, hurt my boobs.
I'm sure it did.
No, I didn't have a sports bra or running shoes. I had these sort of really, and oh God, the photos are hilarious. I had just like gym shoes on. Just like, yeah, that's all I had, really. I'd gone down to Sports Direct and spent like...
Mike.
And I think the top ad was like $2.99 from H&M or something. Yeah.
again, running's one of those beautiful things, much like football. Why is football the world's most popular sport? Because you can kick a can around and call it football. You know, running, you know, it can and does get expensive. I know that. Very quickly, very easily. So you were able to pick it up.
I did actually, because it made me feel good about myself. It was relatively cheap. It was like a little bit of a... What was really enabling about it were the people. I was just surrounded by people who were just really encouraging and nice, and be like, "Hey, Susie, why don't you come and run this race?" I'm like, I don't know if I can, and they're like, "Yeah, come on, it's fine."
I love fitness for that.
Yeah.
So the first gym I ever went to, I was 14. Community straight away, you build a community. The you know rugby, you know my the gym that I worked at. I'm still friends with everybody now. You know, and that's 15, 16 years on from me. 15 years from working there. I think fitness brings people together in a really, really special way.
Absolutely, and for me, running has always been. I know for some people, it's their little escape, and for me, no, I can run by myself. Obviously, I have done for a very, very long way. But for me, it was like my social. It became my sort of social life as well.
And it was good for me. And it's a social life where it's not down the pub.
And it wasn't a conscious shift. It just gradually happened. I was like, this is what's making me feel really good. I'm going to get up at 7:30 a.m. and meet these people, and I'm going to go running with them. We're going to go and run 9 miles, and it's going to be brilliant. And I really enjoyed how that made me feel afterwards.
Was it easy with your daughter?
No, it was really hard. And I look back and I think, oh, bloody hell, that was awful, poor thing. She used to go to her dad's. When she went to her dad's, I'd have more time. Or my mum would sometimes come and look after her just so I could get along. This is when I started to train for the ultramarathons. Mm. Or I'd go and I'd run and it would be like, I'd go and I'd get up really early and then I'd run like 20 miles or whatever and then pick her up from my sister's or whatever and I'd be absolutely done in. And then she'd be like, what should we do? And I'm like, hey!
Yeah, let's go to the park and run around. Push me endlessly.
Yeah. So it was hard. And then she had to stand... And it was when she was probably about 7, 8 sort of thing at that age. So she had to stand in quite a muddy, rainy field several times waiting for me to finish a race or whatever. And that's why she hates running now. Running essentially is, if you look at it, it is quite a selfish thing to do. You know, it takes you out from, unless you're running with your friends, but essentially in a sort of life situation, you're just doing it for yourself, aren't you? And especially ultra running in particular.
How did you get to ultra running from that half marathon?
Oh, complete ignorance. I just don't know how it happened. I did a marathon with my boot camp friends. They were like, let's do a marathon. And I was like, oh my God, no, I couldn't. They're like, come on, we're all doing it.
That? Ooh,
Paris. Can't remember the date. 2012, something like that. 2011, I'm going to say. I did the half marathon, then Paris marathon. And I was like, absolutely not. Are you joking? That I nearly died doing that half marathon. And they were like, no. And it was, again, all very enabling. Like, we're doing it. And there'd be people of all sorts of fitnesses giving it a go. I was like, let's go, let's do it. And then I read about a race called the Marathon des Sables in Runner's World, wanted to know more. And the internet wasn't throwing up the results.
And
like
you'd not heard of it before then?
I had no clue anybody would or could run further than a marathon. I literally didn't know anything about ultra running at all.
It's a 6 day?
6 days, about 250 kilometres. They change it each year through the Sahara Desert. And it's self-sufficient. So that's the really hard bit. So you have to carry everything you need to survive for a week in the Sahara Desert on your back. They give you water, but it is rationed. So they set up like a little sort of bivouac for you. And you run point to point each day and have to carry everything. So all of your survival kits, all your food, which is probably the main bulk of your kit, and then sleeping bag.
How many kilos is that? I don't know.
Well, this is the thing. So there's a minimum you have to have, but then a lot of guys did it, and it's easier for guys to carry. 10, 12 kilograms. Mm. I'm not that tall. I'm 5'4". Yeah. And if I managed to get my pack, it was about 9 kilograms, and it was incredibly tough for me to carry. But you eat your way through it as you...
Of course, so you get lighter.
So it does as you get lighter. Tired. But the first time I did it, it was quite heavy. I'd bought like... silly things, Rich, like a change of socks. Yes, something like that. How ridiculous of me.
Everybody tells you look after your feet, so you're probably thinking,
I'll bring it. And then a lightweight jacket, because it is very cold at night. I finessed that over the years. So I went to do it for the first time in 2013. Everybody told me I shouldn't do it, couldn't do it. I couldn't afford it either, I'm not going to lie. I had to phone up the bank manager and be like...
So do you have to pay to do it?
Yes,
you do.
It's thousands. Two, something like that,
right,
yeah.
So you'd done the half marathon, and then the next big thing you did was the marathon to sub.
Yes. And what happened was, I was fascinated. I was like, people do this? And it was so otherworldly and unachievable and beautiful and gorgeous and just like dreamy. It was like a dream. I just thought, this is like my life's dream, this race. Imagine being out there running, these people are all smiling, running around down sand dunes. I thought, sounds incredible. And so I signed up to the wait list. I was like 125th. I was way down this wait list.
Not going
to
get it.
Well, yeah, it's ridiculous. So I signed onto the wait list to get the emails to find out more, because there wasn't a huge amount of information about it then. I started getting the emails, and then also started to go up the wait list because people drop out because they overtrain or they don't quite finish. They get injured or they can't quite afford it. And then I realised I was going to get in.
How many runners in the
marathon? It depends. So anything from about 600 to 1,000. So it depends on who they take in, which is sort of, there's lots of exterior factors.
How many times have you done it now?
Four.
You going to do it again?
Yeah, probably. That's an exclusive.
So I suppose, thank you very much.
They keep asking me every year, and I'm like, no, I'm sort of done with that. And now I'm like, oh, it's my 50th soon. Maybe the last hurrah in the desert. I don't know. I'll see. I mean, it terrified me, and everybody was like, what are you doing? You can't do this. And that's when I was like, don't tell my dad, because he would just see it as the most colossal waste of time, energy and money possible. And you know, to some, and it's like horses for courses, isn't it? Sometimes I'll look at a sport and I think, why are you doing that for? That is so silly. So I trained really hard, really, really hard for that race. I was running in my lunch hour. I was running. I was getting off the train and running. I was just running everywhere all the time. Any available spare minute I had, I was running and training for that race. And along the way, I did my first ever ultra in training, which was around the Isle of Wight. I thought, if I can't run around the Isle of Wight in June, I will die in the Sahara Desert.
Yes,
so I ran around it. It was actually, it showed me that what is doable.
And just for everybody listening, an ultra is how long?
It's anything longer than a marathon, really. Yeah. And I can remember being, every time I thought about this race, like on the commute in or when in my train, I'd have like a mild panic, you know, like a sort of slightly nervous, sick feeling. Like, oh God. Because I went out by myself. I didn't know anybody there. No, and not many women sort of ran it as well.
What's the percentage, men, women?
Back then, I don't know, 10%? Yeah, something like that. They're really working hard to get it up higher over the last few years. But I had this real moment where I'd scrimped and saved. I'd made it happen, and I was stood on the start line, and I was in the Sahara Desert, and I was just looking around with my huge pack on, it weighed a ton, and I was just like, I am meant to be here. And I just suddenly thought, it's fine, you're going to do this. And that was, up until that point, all the running I'd ever done, I'd be like, I don't know if I can do this, can I do this, I don't know, I'm not sure. And that moment, I was like, I've come home. This is it. And I thought I was going to run that race and it'd be done. No. Ran the race. Extraordinary feeling of accomplishment.
I can only imagine.
And then it just opened the doors. The floodgates opened, and that was it. I was just into ultra running.
So did you do the marathon the next year, the marathon disabled?
I had a weird pattern of roughly every 2 years I'd just go back to it somehow, because there was a reason to go back. I went back 2 years later with my then boyfriend, who's now my husband, and we
did
went
you meet
back
him running.
Yes, obviously I didn't do anything else. I ran, worked, went to bed. We went out, and there was just a small group of friends said, oh, we want to do it. And I was like, yeah, I'll go back. Let's go back. And I did very well that year, because I had spent the last 2 years just doing loads of ultra marathons, more races, more miles. And I'd kind of, my body had sort of caught up with my my race entries. And I just had a beautiful moment where I was running really, really well. And I had a really strong race, and I was I was in the elites, which was absolutely remarkable because I'm not that fast. Everything just came together, and it happens rarely, I would say, in sport. You know, you work very hard in sport, in running. Majority of the time you do your stuff, you're just doing it. Yeah. Sometimes it's going to be sucks and it's horrible, and then sometimes it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's the beautiful times that keep you going. And it just all came together in that race, and so I did really well. I think I was just outside the top 10 women in the end.
I know, spoke to Cracknell.
Cracknell. He needs to eat some solids, that boy. I was like, what are you doing, son? I watched that documentary before and I was like, he needs to eat some solids. Yeah. He's great. He's brilliant.
Meeting people like you and him, that made me feel so lazy, Susie. And I know I'm not a lazy human being.
If it helps, I'm bone idle outside while they're running.
Everybody's got the thing they point towards, right?
Yeah.
But I think he finished 12th or something, which was the highest male.
Then. He's bananas. I've seen Cracknell race, right? Bananas. He operates in a level which only an Olympian can operate on. And I've only seen it a couple of times. My other friend, Ewan Thomas, who I was talking about, there's just like a little something in their head which can make them push themselves far beyond what an average person would stop at.
And it's funny because, again, and talking to him and talking to Sean, they don't get that other people don't think that way.
It's extraordinary. I've seen it. I was an official pacer for London Marathon. Right. Giant flag on my back, and there's a bit in London Marathon where there's a switchback. I was 4 hours, whatever I was doing, and then the front runners came through, and there were all these like teeny tiny runners, and then there was Cracknell in the middle of it, right? And he looked like he was absolutely hanging, right? And I was like, dude is absolutely in the hurt locker there, right? There's absolutely no way he's going to finish with that lock. He just and everyone else looked fine. And it was about, I don't know, 18 miles, something like that. I can't remember the switchback, 17. And I can remember thinking, oh, God, he looks like he was suffering there. And then I finished the race. I looked up where he finished. It was bang on. He just stayed with them the whole way. I just don't know how he did it.
Madness. But I mean, that's you too. You know, you're saying madness.
Yeah, maybe.
That's you too. So what I love about you is, you didn't start until later. Mm. Yeah, if we talk about Cracknell, he did that all the way through. You know, that was his life. You know, was an athlete. He was an Olympian. You know, that was from 18 to 35. That was his life.
Yeah.
But you didn't pick this up until you were 35.
No.
I'm hoping that people listen to this and think, you don't always have to find that thing that you end up doing in love, like, you know, straight away.
Absolutely. And also, it can sometimes just find you. Like, I never thought, I want to be a runner. I can remember watching London Marathon and being like, oh God, imagine being able to run 26 miles. Like those people. Oh my God.
And now you've done, I've just learned through in my research with you about the six majors.
Oh yeah, I've done the World Marathon majors. Yeah, that was fun.
Tell me about that because I didn't know about this and possibly some people won't necessarily know what the majors are.
So the World Marathon majors are six of the biggest marathons in the world and they are London, New York, Berlin, Boston Marathon, Chicago Marathon and Tokyo Marathon. And I'd run two of them back to back. London and Boston were 1 week apart. And I also did that within, I think, a couple of weeks of running my very first 100 miler.
Right.
It was a big month for me. And and I didn't know anything about the World Marathon Majors. It was quite a new concept then. Yeah. So they were put together. It's like, to put these together. And if you run these big marathons, you then go on a Hall of Fame and get a giant medal. And somebody reached out to me on Twitter, as it was, and said, shall I run Sophie Rayworth, my friend? What should I run, London or Boston? Because they're only a week apart. And I wrote back and said, both of them. Why wouldn't you? Or something like that. Anyway, we met in Boston. She was like, all right then. We met in Boston and then ran Boston Marathon, which was extraordinary because it's one of the oldest marathons in the world. Absolutely extraordinary race. And we went out afterwards for burgers and pints, as you do, to celebrate. And then that's when we really found out about the World Marathon Majors. And then we also found out back then, maybe 2015, maybe even earlier, I can't remember the year, maybe 2014, anyway, that there were hardly any women. There were like 30 women had done it. And we were like, let's do that then. And it was hard because I had to run qualifying times to get in all of them, apart from Berlin, which I got in on the ballot because I simply couldn't run that fast. It was too fast for me to get into.
What kind of speed are we talking?
Oh, like sub 120 half marathon, which it's ridiculous. But the rest of them, I had to do like a good for age times. So I had to like really graft away to get into these races, and it's not the cheapest pursuit in the world. So we ticked them off slowly one after the other, and I finished in Chicago Marathon. Which turned out to be the toughest one for me. I had a terrible cough, and it'd come and gone over the course of the year. And I don't really go to the doctors. I'm not one for going to the doctors unless there's something really wrong with me, because I feel like I'm just they're busy people. So I had this cough, and I finally went to the doctor, and I've got this terrible cough, and it just won't go. And they gave me some antibiotics, and it went, but it kept coming back. And I was in Chicago, really excited, about to collect our 6 stars. There's like a little special area you go to at the finish. You see them before, like they make a bit of a fuss of you. And I had this cough, and I was clearing lifts. As soon as I started coughing, people were like pressing on the buttons to get out the lift, because it sounded terrible. I couldn't quite stand up when I was coughing, that's how bad it was. It was really horrible.
And this is before you ran the race even?
Yeah. So I was like, oh no. But like, I had to run the race. I'm not waiting a whole year. I'm not watching my mate Sophie
get collect that like, 6 star.
My mate Sophie and Tim, there were two of them. And I was like, no. I've got to be with them. And I knew by this point, because I'd run lots of ultra marathons, that I could run 26 miles feeling terrible. So I did. I was just coughing my way through that. I started off all smiles, and then
You've seen photos, you just get less and less.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And Sophie was at the end. She was really worried about me. She didn't say it at the time. I could see her looking at me, and she grabbed my hand. We had about a mile to go. And I can remember saying to her, if I faint, don't let them take me off the course, because it means I wouldn't have got.
Oh, really? So if you go off the course, then you're done.
If they take off the course, you're done. So I was like, if I faint, don't let them
just
take
me. Just leave me. I'll just be on the floor. I'll get myself up.
Sort me out. It'll be fine. Finished. I was seeing stars, and they were interviewing us. There was a TV camera, and they were like, okay, here's 6 stars, da da da. And we were sort of chatting, and I turned to Sophie and I said, I'm going to faint. And I just faint. I just went. And
Was it filmed?
I can't remember. It probably was, actually. But I think I was like very British. I was like, excuse me. And then fainted.
I'm going to lie down here if you don't mind.
I'm terribly sorry. And then she was like, oh my God, because I'd run like 100 miles. I'd done all these.
Yeah, so she knew that wasn't okay.
Yeah, it was not normal. So I went to the medical tent, and I was lying there with her, and she was like, oh my God, are you okay? And I was watching people being put on drips, and I was like, okay, I'm not that bad. I've just fainted. I just maybe need to eat. So I had this cough. I phoned up the doctor. They were like, you need to sort that cough out. That cough is debilitating. Doesn't sound right. Phoned up the doctor from America, flew home, got my chest x-rayed, and they found a massive cancerous lump at the top of my neck, which was causing the cough. And I had thyroid cancer, and I didn't know.
How long do you think you'd had it at that point?
It was quite big by that point. So I think I'd been feeling off and on pretty ropey for about a year.
So you were running, you were doing these ultras, all of this with thyroid.
I was just getting slower and slower and sort of sweatier and just more cumbersome. And I was just like, oh, I'm just getting... You put it down to, maybe I'm a bit busy
at work. You're doing a lot, right?
Yeah, I was running a lot of marathons. Maybe I'm just getting older. And you just... Because the symptoms are so incredibly vague, I didn't quite know. And I was like, huh.
That'll be why.
Oh!
So it kind of makes sense now. How did you feel when they told you it was cancer?
I was, when people start talking to you about things like that, again, Sophie came with me, bless her heart. When people start talking to you about things like that, your mind just goes like that. And you just start thinking about a million different things, and you stop listening to what they're saying. You just hear like 2 words, and you genuinely don't know what to think. Like you just sort of go, well, I did. I was just like, sorry, what? And then you're just processing that, and then they go, okay, thank you, goodbye. And then you walk out the door, and then you have to go back for like a follow-up, but you're just like, I was just in a bit of a daze. It was like an out-of-body experience.
Were you scared?
I don't feel like being scared was, I didn't feel it has an overwhelming feeling. I remember thinking, oh great, like being a little bit let down with my body, like I thought I could run along. It was a little bit like, what?
How dare you?
Are you joking? And this, just to tie this in with where I was in my sort of career, I had a few months earlier been offered sponsorship. I was doing the running thing, I was doing the museum thing, and it got to the point where I wasn't really doing either of them particularly.
It's hard. Like, at a certain point, you've got to make a choice, right?
So I was juggling the job, I was running all these sort of long distances, so I was knackered at work. It was, and the Instagram thing was beginning to sort of swell a little bit, and I just had this opportunity for sponsorship. And so after a lot of a massive amount of courage it took, because I have a real sort of confidence crisis when it comes to anything to do with money, because I've always been so poor. And it'd be like, I can't not have a monthly wage coming in to pay my mortgage. It's like, it stressed me out just thinking about it, but I took the plunge. So that happened about 3 months before I got cancer. It was like a local lawyers. They just gave me just enough to sort of cover what would be my mortgage, not my bills. And so I was like, okay. And then I was doing a bit of commentating, a bit of presenting, and that was really...
And that all came from social media?
All from social media. That was really taking effect, and then I was doing sort of just working with brands like Adidas, whatever, to do little activations.
So they just came to you, all because you put yourself out there?
Yeah, I was just documenting what I was doing.
Did
and I
that
was,
come quite naturally to you?
I wasn't just so you know, there was absolutely zero strategy. I never set out to pick up sponsorship. It just happened. And it wasn't a lot of money, but it was just enough to make me think maybe I could, if I did like one commentary gig a week, and it would be, I'd just about cover my bills.
Yeah.
And so...
Commentary for who?
Race commentating. So like, you know, half marathons or marathons, I'll be there doing that. And I just... panicked. I proper panicked when I found out I wasn't well. And then Intersport were another company that I became one of their sponsored athletes. And so I was like, brilliant. And then all of a sudden, like, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be seen as unhealthy.
It's going to be taken away from you.
Yeah, it's all going to be taken away from me.
Was that the concern?
That was my main concern. I wasn't like, am I going to... I wasn't fearful like that.
I mean, I don't know anything about thyroid cancer.
It's one of the nicest... If
you can choose a cancer...
Yeah, it's easy. It depends on... I can only talk about my experience. So this is why I don't really dwell on it, because I see other people and their cancer journeys, and it's... hard, it's really rough, and mine was incredibly straightforward.
Because you were just able to have an operation.
It was encapsulated. They just took it out, and it's like, yeah. Right, it's gone now.
And it hadn't travelled anywhere else, there wasn't
No,
any.
I was very lucky. I was very, very lucky. The whole process was only a few months from start to finish.
Lily would have been a teenager at this point. Yeah. Was that hard for her?
I didn't really tell her.
We've spoken much about it since.
I didn't want to worry her, because it's terrifying, isn't it? So I sort of didn't really, and then I said, I've got to have an operation. Then it's like, oh, then I told her afterwards. I said, but it's fine now. She was trying to do a GCSE. No, she doesn't need this. You don't need this in your life. Yeah, so I was very lucky.
Were you public about the cancer? Did you share it on social?
I did one post, and then one post afterwards, and then I just was like, cracked on business as usual. Because I'm not one for being like, I'm not well today. It's just not really my nature.
I mean, you seem incredibly optimistic and positive.
It's what it is, and it was treated and it was gone. But there is, I'll be lying to say that it was like completely gone, because there was like an after effect where you're like, don't quite trust your body. You're like, why is that? Why am I aching there? And then I had to sort of just undo some of the insecurities that being unwell gave to me. Mm. And I undid it by doing a lot of ultra marathons in quite a short space of time to sort of prove to myself that I could still do these things. So I did, I didn't ask my oncologist, I did a half marathon about 2 weeks after the operation.
How did you feel?
I was delighted.
You felt great.
I felt alive. I was like, there's a photo of me punching the sky. It was like Vitality Half London one. And I was like, if I don't feel well, I'll just stop. It's fine. It's totally not worth it. And then I get to about 9 miles, pretty much like my first one. I was like, I'm going to finish. And I was there. I'm like, woo, with the crowds. And then I did and then I went to do the Marathon de Saab about 2 months later. And then I did 100 miler. And then I was like, I think I need to sit down now. I've proved that I'm
you're okay.
I'm okay. Yeah.
And so how did Peloton come into the picture?
This was the thing, and I didn't realise it was the thing, but this was the thing. It's going to sound really, really cheesy. I'll tell you what happened. So I was sort of doing my thing. I was doing the commentating. Mm-hmm. I picked up another sponsorship, quite a bigger one at this point, with a brilliant fitness shoe company called Mizuno. Really supportive. I was doing, you know, a few of the activations, but things were sort of ticking along really, really nicely. And then COVID happened, and I was like, uh-oh, right. Like the whole world. I mean, I was not alone in that sort of slight, oh, right, panic about things. And amazingly, I still had a bit of work through Mizuno. The contract remained, and we did what we could with the circumstances. So I was very, very lucky. And then I just got a DM. We're launching the Tread in the UK. We'd like to talk to you. And I thought... Oh, yeah, they probably want me to, like, do a little some selfies, or do something for Instagram, maybe do a post, maybe test it out, maybe come to a class. You know, I genuinely thought that's what it was. So I was like, yeah, sure, here's my email.
Of course, Peloton had become such an incredibly huge company, especially, I know they were before, but during the pandemic.
Yeah, huge, massive.
I think it changed people's lives, and it gave them a way to do what they were previously doing, but then couldn't do in their home.
It gave people a space to work out so they could get moving. It was the community aspect. I can't speak more highly of all those qualities that all those good qualities that, that the fitness community have, they're there in Peloton. And you have that without even leaving your home. People make friends, people... It's just extraordinary. It's the most enabling space, and also the most enabling company. And so I had this message, and they wanted me to audition to be an instructor. And I said, "Do you know how old I am?" Because I was 47, and in my head, fitness companies go for young people in their 20s, and Peloton aren't about that. They're just like, no, fitness for everybody. And so that was like, oh my God, this company. And so I did the auditions. It's quite a long process, and I got the job. And what I did do, I can remember very much thinking from the get-go that I wasn't going to... I didn't look at a class. I just didn't want to be influenced by other...
I understand that.
I just thought, I'm going to be myself. Mm. And if I'm not right, then it is what it is. And then in my head thinking, that's a bit of a risk, Susie. Yeah. But I just thought, I'll just be myself and not try and pretend to be anything other than who I am, because if I did and then I end up getting further...
Thought, they're looking for that. Then they're looking for this cheerleader type kind of... Yeah.
So I was just myself, and I didn't want to have to be a version of myself or whatever. I didn't want to have to then fake it. Unbelievably, I got the job, and this is going to sound so cheesy, but I think this is where it's led to. This is where I'm supposed to be. Like, I love running. I love what it's done to me.
I'm getting the impression that you might.
But I love, it's not necessarily like the speed or the pace. I just love what it's brought to my life. And I love how it's made me feel about myself. And I love how it's given me confidence. And I love the people I've met through it. Just the whole community thing. Everything about running has completely changed my life. And to be able to do this job and see other people get on the journey is just, honestly, I feel emotional talking about it. I get messages from people like, I've run my first mile. I signed up for my first marathon, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so excited for you. You're going on this journey. It's yours and it's beautiful.
And there you are telling me you're not a deep thinker.
But it's just, but it's only because I think because I can relate to all of them. I've been that person that can't run for 10 minutes. I know what that person's going through. I know how hard it is to start into fitness, because it is really hard. And out of all the things I've done, and I've done some very difficult things, probably one of the hardest things is being consistent at the start and just saying, I'm going to come back to this. This is horrible. This is hard work. I'm going to come back to this. And just keeping that consistency at the start by myself, really, really tough. And so people that do that by themselves, just keep coming back to their treads. Like, okay, I'm going to run for a little bit longer, another 5 minutes today. I'm like, yes, you. Go, do it.
And it's beautiful because it can lead to, that your brother saying, hey, I'm doing this half marathon, you need to come do it with me, led to you breaking a world record.
Not run since, just putting that out there.
Has he not? Oh, it's Alan, right?
He's done a couple of small little ones, but can't be tempted.
That's because you've overshadowed him completely.
Tis but a footnote, no.
But it led to you then breaking a world record over a 12-hour period.
Some of the things I've done. That was horrible. Yeah, that was an accident that came about.
Yeah, I often run for 60-plus miles accidentally.
What happened was I didn't know that it was possible. I was training for an Ironman at the time, so I was super fit. I didn't realize the problem with fitness is sometimes when you're really fit, you don't realise how fit you are in the moment. I was super fit, and my friend, Dr. Chris Howe, who has been with me on my running journey from that very first marathon to Saab's to my latest race, Badwater 135, he is a sports scientist, and he was trying to collate some experiments around ultra running. Not much study has gone into it. And he needed to have sort of basically an experiment where people ran for 50 miles, and then he collated everything they ate, drank, weighed, took blood tests, sort of sweat tests, saliva tests, a lot of experiments on you whilst you ran 50 miles on a treadmill in a sports science lab. And not many people wanted to do that idea. I said, yeah, I'll come and run 50 miles on a treadmill for you. And I did, ran it quite fast because I was super fit, and went home, just did a tweet about it or something, went home. And then somebody said, if you'd kept running, you would have broken the world record. And I was like, what? I was 46 at the time, and I was like, I could get a running world record at 46. And so we set about doing it, and it was quite difficult because you need a lot to satisfy Guinness. There was 26 pages of rules and regulations, and it was really tough. So we had to do a lot of elaborate things to keep them happy. Had to be open to the public. All manner of random people came in to watch. I'm like, I don't know. The calibration of the treadmill, the whole thing had to be filmed, had to be streamed live. So we had it was an operation. And what happened was I went in and I was actually a little bit stressed at this point because somebody had tweeted it and then it had gone, not viral, but it got out and I started.
The running community is quite a tight one, right? Like, you know, social media wise.
Yeah.
If somebody's doing something a little bit different.
Yeah, but I think Sophie tweeted it and then it got picked up by Piers Morgan of all people and then he retweeted it and then like all these, and I was just like, so then all these people are like, what? Why would you do? No, all those people like that couldn't comprehend Ultra and be like, why would you do that? So this whole, I woke up to like thousands of tweets and I was like, oh Lord. And then I got on the treadmill. And I started running and I was like, oh no, I'm not feeling this today. And it was a slog.
How far in were you before you got
2 miles in? And I was like, this is horrible. I'm not feeling it.
It was 68.4 miles. So you've got another 66.4 miles to go. And you're thinking, yeah, I'm not up for this.
Yeah, I was thinking it's not today. Sometimes running just does that to you. You just think, oh, it's hard today. And it was hard that day.
But you did it.
I did it. It was horrible. I was sick as a dog. Absolutely not.
Would you attempt any sort of world record again?
Depends what it is.
Yeah?
Yeah. If you find... I mean, it depends what it is. So when I started ultra running, there were very few women. Now there's lots and lots of women, of incredible, incredible women running astonishing times and just being brilliant at it. I am bang average in the ultra world. Bang average. Right? And I know I can run 100 miles, but I am bang average at running 100 miles. So there are women out there that are just doing extraordinary things in ultra running.
The amazing thing is, though, Susie, you've probably inspired an awful lot of those.
I don't know if I have or haven't, but what I would like to think is I'd like to inspire the people that think they can't do it, because genuinely, you can. It's all about your mindset. And you don't have to be super fast, of which I'm not. You just have to be quite tenacious. I think I just want to give it a go.
What next for you?
Well, I've just finished a really big race and it was all I could think about for years. It was like my dream race. And for me, it's the top of the tree. It's the top of the tree. And I finally plucked up the courage to do
it.
It's the
125.
135.
135, my apologies. That's
an extra 10 miles.
Sorry, Susan.
It's very painful.
I'm sure they were.
it's a race called Badwater 135 and it's 135 miles non-stop. So I hadn't run that far before in my life, and it goes over 3 mountain ranges, so the biggest elevation I've ever done in my life in a race. And it also happens to be in Death Valley, the hottest place on earth, and it's done at the hottest time of the year. So it's serious business. It's really, really serious. And it's an invitational race, so you have to be selected to run. And that the reason for that is really because you need to know what you're doing. You need to... It's essentially a very dangerous environment. There's nothing there. The average life expectancy in Death Valley is 14 hours, and we have 48 hours to run 135 miles through it.
Jesus. How are you sleeping?
I wasn't. I just fell asleep a couple of times running.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I was hallucinating. Yes, you can. I've done it a few times. Oh, yeah, you'll be running and then you'll be like that. Oh, I'm nearly...
See, I've experienced that, I guess, when I'm driving and it's late and, you know, you do that thing where you open the windows and you think, Jesus, I'll just stick your head out.
Yeah.
You can genuinely fall asleep.
Oh, I have fallen asleep running several times.
I've never heard that before in my life.
Yeah, and you think, maybe I can get away with this. Oh, no, I'm going to fall over.
You don't fall over?
Yeah, I'll fall over, yeah. Yeah.
So you did the Badwater 135.
135. It was incredibly tough, but I finished.
That's the pinnacle. So where is there to go?
I don't
from there?
Know now. You see, that's the thing. It was for me the one. Yeah. It was the one, and I got in, which is an achievement itself. And I finished, and I loved it. Every fibre of my being loved that race. Even when I was in chronic pain, I was just like, it's such a privilege.
I think that's
such a privilege.
The thing that has come through with everything you've said is just an appreciation for it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
An enjoyment if you can, because, you know, I know you've spoken about type 2 fun and...
Yeah, yeah. It's I was in this extraordinary environment, which I love. Yeah. Extraordinary, beautiful. I love the desert. I was doing the race of my dreams and I'd made it. So I was just like, I can remember being the start line, and you've got to enjoy this. You've got to enjoy this. And because I had that, I had a sort of lightness in my chest. I've done some horrible races and I've been like, this is horrible and drudge. And I've really sort of felt miserable inside, but I'm finished. But that one, there was just a lightness in my head and my chest because I just thought, this is it. You're meant to be here. You've got to get this done.
It's incredible. And your 50th is one?
2 years' time.
Oh, so 2 years. I don't know. Your 50th is coming.
Yeah,
up,
I might drum up something for that. But at the moment, no, I've just got that out of the way. You know, I'll probably do another 100 miler, that sort of thing. Pop a couple of them in the diary. I've got New York Marathon in a couple of weeks.
I was going to say, I guess when you're as fit as you are, and you know, it's just like, yes, I can do that. So why not keep doing that until you don't want to do it?
Yeah, I'm going to the reasons are now. It's all about it's so ridiculous. Going on holiday with my friends, run 100 miles, that sort of thing. So I'll do it as a social thing. So there's a group of us like, yeah, we'll sign up for that 100 miler somewhere nice and sunny. Honestly, bloody yeah. Hell. So it's a social it's a destination thing.
It's such a long way from where you were. I know. Sat feeling the way that you did before you even started on this journey. So I think anybody listening that thinks that they can't, you're saying they can.
100%. You have really got to want to. And I would say, you know, I've talked about running 100 miles. I've talked about doing these extraordinary things. That doesn't have to be your goal. You can literally decide that your aim is to go and run park run. You want to get moving. You want to get 5K done. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be grandiose. It doesn't have to be in an extraordinary place.
How do you find where your local park run is?
Just Google. Literally, park run. There should be one near you. They're all over the country. It's a free 5K run or walk. Check it out.
Yeah, also, there's a lovely community around it as well, right?
Yeah, having said that, but primarily you want to get on the Peloton app.
let's remember.
Yeah, there's an app, you can download the app, and you can have me. You can come running with me. You can download a little outdoor run or walk, and just get moving. There's a joy in movement. It's a privilege in being able to do it, and just 20 minutes, 15 minutes in your day, even 10 minutes. I think sometimes people think you have to be doing something for an hour if it's fitness. Not at all. Just get out.
Well, it would make me incredibly happy if somebody comes to a class of yours and says that they came through this.
Yes.
That would make me very, very happy. How cool would that be? Yeah, I came from the starting line. This is my starting line.
Yeah.
That would make me very, very happy. Well, Susie, I think we've got to wrap it up. Thank you so much for talking to us. I think it's incredible to hear how you got to where you are. Have you got anything you wanted to say before we wrap up?
No, just you're never too old, honestly. You really are never too old. And just, it's better to try, I think. And give something a go. I know that's really hella cheesy, but it's true. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
And there we have it. Susie Chan, an incredible listen, an incredible person, infectiously positive, just wonderfully so. Some phenomenal stories in that. And does it make you feel like wanting to go for a run? Because it kind of does me. Whatever you do, if she's motivated you in any way, feel free to drop her a follow and a comment on Instagram at Susie_Chan_. She is, lest we forget, or was named the number one runner to follow on Instagram by Runner's World and the Evening Standard. So absolutely go find her there. She posts really fun things about her work at Peloton and the runs she does. So go say hello. Tell her the Starting Line podcast sent you. Thank you very much. To you as the listener, again, this is not the end of series one. We are coming back with a couple of episodes behind the scenes. Ask away. Ask me any question you have. If it's, no matter how small, is it technical? Is it about a guest? Is it about me? Is it about any aspect of the Starting Line podcast? If so, email hello@startinglinepod.com. Get in touch across social media channels. That's at Starting Line Show. Or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Starting Line Podcast. You'll find it. Message, comment, DM, whatever you want to do. I will, obviously, credit you. I'll mention your name and where you got in touch and respond to the question, if I can, as well as talk about the brilliant, brilliant guests we've had and bring you some behind the scenes. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast or followed it, click the button. It's quick, it's easy. Some wonderful, wonderful guests coming up. You do not want to miss them. If you're following, it auto-downloads. It tells you about it straight away. And it helps us too. Thank you and goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.